Hello, Social Chemist listeners. Before anything, Happy New Year's. I hope you all had an amazing holiday break with your loved ones. I know I'm late and all, but I'm still settling into my new environment. That being said, I thought it would be nice to start the new year with an interview with an informational specialist who has recently published an academic scholarly journal on the negative implications of conspiratorial ideologies. So, enjoy today's episode as we continue to understand the conspiratorial mindset. Oh, and one last thing. I want to give a huge shout out to my future sister and brother-in-law, Anna and Sabino, and their child, little Ezekiel, for allowing me to use their home to record this episode while I get settled into my new home. I hope you guys enjoy the Portuguese food I brought as a thank you, and I can only hope that by the time you listen to this episode, we would have caught Cinderace in the new Pokemon game we're playing. But anyways, let's dive in. Hello, everyone. Welcome to this edition of the Social Chemist Podcast with your host, Nelson Perez. Today, I am joined by Bradley Wiles, an associate professor and head of special collections and archives at Northern Illinois University. As of this recording, Bradley is finishing his doctorate through the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee School of Information. Above all, with the help of Peter Lohr and Johannes Brits, he published a journal article, Rethinking Information Ethics, Truth, Conspiracy Theories, and Librarians in the COVID-19 Era, a research paper that asked the question of whether neutrality within the librarian profession does more harm than good. Bradley, thank you for joining me.
Hey, Nelson, thank you for having me.
I'm so excited about this conversation. You know, like I said, thank you so much. And
absolutely.
Before we jump in, you know, let's loosen, you know, the jaw a little bit. You know, the first question I wanted to ask you, I know we're like 13 days into the new year, but how was your New Year's? How did you celebrate the holidays?
That was good. We I went on a little trip to Nebraska. Actually, that's where a lot of my family still lives. So We were there, and otherwise had a pretty quiet holiday. And you know, didn't do much. I have a couple of kids there in 7th and 4th grade, and yeah. So I mean, it was just pretty relaxing. Actually, very nice. We usually travel a lot during holidays, and we didn't do it so much this time, just for a short trip during the new year. So it was cool. Yeah. How about yourself?
It was good, calm, quiet. Try to enjoy my winter break as a graduate student. You know, it's tough writing those papers, doing those quizzes, a lot of studying. Sure. So once I had the opportunity, I just slept. Let me tell you, sleep is a beautiful, you know, it's a beautiful thing.
It's way underrated. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely. Yes. So for the listeners, we're going to be talking about conspiracy theories and misinformation. And I want to go back to March of 2020. At the time, you know, I believe the World Health Organization had stated that the coronavirus was a pandemic. And soon after, we saw a whole bunch of conspiracy theories just blow up out of nowhere. We had microchips, the vaccines are killing us. 5G, the LGBTQ community is kidnapping children to feast off, you know, adrenochrome. And As a researcher, what were your thoughts going into this? Were you excited? Were you sad? Were you scared? Like, what was the feeling?
Sure. Well, so I guess during, you know, March 2020, just thinking back on that, I at that point, I was doing my dissertation, the doctoral dissertation proposal, you know, which is kind of that last step that you take once you're done with coursework and you're getting ready to undertake the research and write the dissertation. And so the shutdown that occurred, you know, in March 2020, when everything just kind of just stopped, was actually worked out really great for me, because I had, mm-hmm. I all of a sudden had lots of time and sort of a controlled mm-hmm. environment to be able to really focus on something. So like from a personal logistics standpoint, you know, it couldn't have worked out better, but mm-hmm. there was just this sense of fear. And I remember in the lead up, you know, you heard about COVID coming around the corner towards the end of 2019. And then, you know, those first couple of months. But I think that I was like a lot of people that just sort of thought, well, you know, it's going to be like SARS or bird flu or West Nile or one mm-hmm. of these things where they're, you know, they'll get a hold of it. Like it'll be mm-hmm. okay. Like it's not going to be just this. So, you know, I think that a lot of people were so surprised by like how abruptly everything shut down. And to me, if you have this sort of environment where people are already kind of politically on edge and divided, and there's already this really vast ferment of conspiracy culture and kind of conspiracy mindedness, especially what's going on in the web, and then you have this very catastrophic, traumatic, and, you know, kind of damaging event, then all these things that are sort of bubbling underneath the surface are just going to explode. And I think that that's what happened. And so really it's, you know, right away in March, you start to see March and April, really, you start to see all this stuff about, like you said, 5G, microchip vaccines, Bill Gates and the Gates Foundation, you know, supposedly mm-hmm. undertaking their nefarious things and working with Fauci, and then how this is a cover up for a biochemical weapons program that had mm-hmm. been going on in Wuhan, China, you know, for however long. All these things that, you know, they had some connection, you know, in reality. You know, because it was, you know, the Gates Foundation, obviously, that's one of the things they do, is they do vaccine efforts in different parts of the world. That's, you know, and there was a research lab in Wuhan, China, where everything, mm-hmm. You know, kind of the ground zero of everything. And so mm-hmm. just all these little sort of kernels of truth or like kernels of fact, all of a sudden were just extrapolated and connected. And I think that that's the nature of conspiracy theory, especially people that are engaged in these cultures. It's sort of like taking a thread and running with it. It doesn't really matter what the factual basis is of mm-hmm. of that thread. It's really whatever the assumption that even the wildest things that you can imagine are not beyond, or they're not, you know, sort of something that we wouldn't do, or that the people in power wouldn't do. And so if you have that kind of skepticism and distrust of power that's already ingrained, which I think is a very American thing, really, mm-hmm. Then, you know, again, it was just kind of a perfect storm, and it all came to a head. And then it just, you just watched 2020 unfold with everything else. And it was, mm-hmm. it was crazy.
Yeah. Going back to 2020, you know, when mm-hmm. The pandemic started and all these conspiracies started just spewing out, I saw a lot of my friends succumb to these ideologies again, 5G, the microchip, Bill Gates. In where you were located, did you find, you know, or did you see this increase of conspiratorial ideologies in like your own personal life?
I don't think so, but I think that part of that it was that I lived at that time, you know, doing a PhD program, and kind of mm-hmm. in the community that I was in, and mm-hmm. what I have kind of surrounded myself with. And I'm not big on social media, for example. Like I don't go into Reddits, you know, and do like chats, or I don't know whatever they do on Reddit. You know, I'm not really enmeshed in a lot of these.
We won't find you on TikTok then.
No, probably not anytime soon. Yeah. So I think that unless you're like sort of already mm-hmm. kind of ingrained in it, I've always looked at this kind of more from like a detached scholarly point of view. And I started getting into like the conspiracy theories, mainly based on a lot of things that I read. You know, I like mm-hmm. conspiracy theory based movies and books and, you know, things like that. And so, but it was never anything. I think that I had maybe one disagreement on like a Facebook thing with somebody mm-hmm. About this, and kind of called out that, hey, this is nonsense. And there was disagreement about that. And mm-hmm. After that, I kind of thought it's not really worth it. But you could just mm-hmm. see it, you know, really in the news. And, you know, I do pay attention to all those kinds of things. And like, of course, you couldn't avoid it during the mm-hmm. whole you have the conspiracy theorist in chief, you know, running the country. I mean, so really, whether or not you were actively trying to participate in this, it didn't really make any difference. You know, you would be exposed to it somehow. And where I lived in the city, it was Milwaukee at the mm-hmm. time. You know, there's been a lot of troublesome, for example, race relations and some other things. And there's some really powerful kind of right wing and reactionary forces, you know, within that city, even though it's a very kind of liberal and diverse, you know, mm-hmm. Municipality. And so just the, you know, again, kind of that, those underlying tensions, I think, you know, sort of led to some of it. And then once, you know, you have businesses shutting down and people having to be laid off and, you know, all these mm-hmm. other things that kind of result from trying to manage the pandemic, that, you know, I think it just made it worse. The masking thing was a big part of it too, you know, because mm-hmm. I think that was a big part of it. It's not so much a product of like the conspiracy theory culture or anything like that, but it's more, it kind of became a marker of your values. You know, if you were masking all the time, if you were inside or outside or regardless, or if you weren't, like, there was just this tendency to look at other people differently because of that, you know. And I admit that that's how I felt a lot of the time too. And I think it's just part of being scared, you know. It's part of not knowing mm-hmm. what's going to happen. So I don't know. So again, yeah, I think it was sort of in those subtle things that would trickle down like on the street, but man, we were just packed inside for so much of the time too. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard if you didn't, I don't know, like you couldn't miss it. Like it would kind of rope you in regardless of whatever your yeah. position was or your stance, mm-hmm. or if you were actively trying to participate in it, but I didn't really seek anything out, you know. It just sort of, you know, and with this article and some other stuff that I've done since then, mm-hmm. it really kind of built on pre-existing, research interests and personal interests and things mm-hmm. like that.
Did you gain an interest in misinformation because of the pandemic, or was this something that you had like prior to everything going wild?
I think that I had an interest in it, but it was more from a like kind of like a policy and ethics standpoint, because that's mm-hmm. sort of my focus. What I've been doing in this, my information studies program, is looking at different policy and ethics areas. And of course, you know, especially looking at official policies for information management, records management, all these other things that have become really big in the news recently, you know, with mm-hmm. Both, you know, the current president and the former president's trouble with managing classified information and you know, records after the fact and things like that. But yeah. that's just one of many of these types of stories. So I'd kind of had an interest in that from that point of view. The misinformation, disinformation, and conspiracy theory, that really, I guess, yeah, it sort of did coincide with it, because it was really just so impressive how all of a sudden, you know, you have policy decisions being directed by conspiracy theories, by things that, and misinformation and disinformation, things that just flatly were not true, and that came from these, you know, sectors of like the population in general that before then had basically zero legitimacy or zero credibility, you know, when it came to things like managing public health you know, some of these other things. So it was really like all of a sudden, and this kind of goes back to what we were talking about before, like all this just stuff became mainstreamed. And so there was just no way to avoid it. And so, yeah, I think there was a coincidence there, but this really made me look at it from the position that, you know, this is really dangerous. The fact that this is happening now, you know, that, you know, we have this sort of this attitude that's unmoored ethically, morally, and, you know, in some cases legally from any sort of standards, you know, that we normally use to try to manage crises.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, since you said that you're engaged with, you know, information policies and stuff of that sort, you know, one of the questions that I want to ask you is, and again, this is just give your opinion, do you think that we are living in the golden age of conspiratorial ideologies?
You know, I think I talked about that. I mean, I really, based on what I've read and other, you know, research and just really my own observations over time in my life and the different communities I've lived in, I think that conspiracy theories and conspiracy culture, it's a very American thing. That's not to say that it doesn't exist everywhere. And there have been conspiracy theories and you know, this idea of resisting like kind of these powerful nefarious forces that secretly control things. That's been around forever. You know, a lot of the conspiracy theories that we have now, they're really just updated versions, variations of conspiracy theories that go back centuries, you know, in some instances, thousands of years sometimes. So I would say that we are in a golden age of the, as far as like the rapidity and like kind of the instant or like almost immediate influence of these, you know, because it's literally when you hear people talk about like family members that have bought into the QAnon stuff or that have done, you know, some of these other things, like these other, like the militia movements and like sovereign citizens and like all these other things, like people that have kind of bought into it. It's how abruptly things have changed. And I think that part of that is that, you know, we are now able to construct these kind of information bubbles around ourselves. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we seek out the things that confirm our existing beliefs, and we actively avoid anything that might contradict that or disprove that. And so it makes it really easy for these things to spread and for people to kind of really go all in on it. And I don't know that that was possible 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. You know, I don't necessarily blame it on social media. I guess I just think it's made it easier. Maybe something like this was inevitable. But again, that conspiracy strain has always been part of this country. I mean, it's just, I think it's part of who we are. And that's probably true in other countries too, but I don't really know. I can just speak to what, you know, my experience living in this country my whole life.
Yeah, you know, I definitely agree with you because, you know, when we think about the internet, when it first started, it was, you know, just this cute, you know, maybe not the word cute, but it was, you know, based on information, you know, things that you can access. And then as we progressed, we then developed social media. We had MySpace. I don't know if you recall that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and it was like calm. It was innocent. And then, you know, with the progression, we started having influencers, and then now these influencers are now, you know, influencing, you know, the people on the internet. Right. And it's become so toxic that, you know, I make this comment to someone that you literally don't have to have a PhD in anything, because so long as you sound confident and you have the proper equipment, anyone can believe you. Like, and there's so many people, you know, Andrew Tate is a good example of this. I don't know if you've heard of him, but this guy, just his message has spread and so quickly. And I don't think that this would have been possible, you know, 20 years ago, like you said. So, man,
it makes it easy to kind of mainstream these like repulsive things or things that other, you know, because you can make really, if you're, I guess, talented enough or gifted enough, then you can really make like the most repugnant ideas seem appealing to somebody. You know, somebody's going to respond to it. There's always an audience out there. One of the more interesting things I read recently, and I can't remember where, it was some kind of an article, but it was talking about how we've gone from, we went particularly with the kind of what was called the Web 2.0. We went from the social networking era, which would have been like early, you know, MySpace, and there are several others that even predate that. And then, you know, to Facebook, and then kind of up towards like Twitter, but we went from social networking to the social media area. And that's a very different thing, because when we're talking about social networking, we're talking about relationships and communities and interacting and really trying to build out, you know, again, those social networks. And there's been theories on social networking for centuries now. People have been talking about, sociologists and, you know, political scientists, all these people, they've had these theories on social networks and how those are created. And the web was largely seen as kind of an extension of that, of the things that were going on in communities. Well, now it's all about social media, which really comes down to content. And just having content, and just making sure that all that content is that you have things that are constantly refreshed and something new. And so it's like, you have to, once you get that one thread, you have to keep pulling them, because that's how you engage people. It's not so much about community. It's just about having that new piece of information or that new lead or that new tangent, you know, to kind of go down. And so it's, yeah. And I think that I think that you're right. I think that generally, it has moved to from something that was more like kind of community based and had a more benevolent kind of aspect to it, to something that is really, I don't know, it just became really toxic And who knows? Who knows what's going to happen, especially with like Twitter, when you see what's going on with that, you know?
I'm still contemplating if I'm going to join Twitter just to, you know, expand my horizon. But I was going to comment.
You might regret that.
I gotta see what Elon Musk is saying on Twitter. But, you know, I was going to comment that, you know, you mentioned earlier that you're not on social media. So it's like you're not like that exposed to it. So I think like your mind is more in a optimistic mood than I am, because when I go on Facebook, when I go on Instagram, I follow all these conspiracy theorists. And let me tell you, it gets depressing. It's saddening. And
I think that a lot of it's fascinating. I mean, it really is. And I guess I should be fair. I do have a Facebook account. You know, I'm not super active, and I don't, you know, because I mean, I think part of this was, you know, you use these tools, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in like flame wars over the dumbest things. And so it's like, I think I just actively tried to scale back, you know, because it's like, how often do I need to insult a relative, you know, or a friend from high school? Like, I don't want to do that. And so I can't imagine what's, I mean, to me, I actively do kind of seek these things out, or there are certain areas that I have some interest in. And, you know, of course there's books and there's all kinds of these other things that I'm interested in that kind of lead me to this. But I couldn't imagine like being, you know, sort of bombarded with like surrounding myself with that. So I definitely give you kudos for, you know, taking that on, because that's a rough job. But I should also say that I think that there's been this kind of laundering of ideas, because like we talk about social media and the web as being these kind of hotbeds, you know, for this activity, but it also trickles out through, you know, mainstream media and through what would be considered like sort of legitimate legacy or establishment media outlets, you know, and then inevitably it ends up in communities. And I think that's what you see, especially with libraries, where you have people showing up to library board meetings and school board meetings, things like that, and calling teachers and librarians groomers, you know, and some of these other things. So it's there is it. It wouldn't be. I don't think it would be as scary if these things just lived and died online. You know what I mean? But the fact is, they don't.
Yeah, that is the terrifying part, how the conspiracy theories have evolved in the last, I'm gonna say, 5 years. But you know, you mentioned librarians, and in your paper you kind of talk about how conspiratorial ideologies have forced the profession of librarians to kind of rethink how they practice their discipline. And if you can just tell us a little bit about, you know, what you mean by that, how conspiracy theories have affected the career of librarians.
Right. I think it is conspiracy theories as part of a larger information ecosystem. That's really what it is. So that would include things like propaganda and government policy and disinformation and misinformation and the kind of digitalization of all information access and consumption and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's really kind of part of this larger changing landscape of information activity, library information activity. But I think that part of it is, you know, libraries are these venerable institutions within communities, you know, for many, many years now, for at least century and a half, two centuries, you know, that we've had public libraries. Well, libraries really of any sort, but like, you know, kind of libraries as an institution, they go back much longer than that. But as far as being kind of these core essential parts of communities, both public libraries as well as academic institutions and other like kind of special research areas, they have this legacy, I guess, credibility and authority that they have. And so I think that as things change, and especially as things like conspiracy theories become more mainstreamed, part of the goal of that, or part of the effect anyway, is that it erodes any kind of institutional authority, or it, you know, calls into question the expertise and the motivations and the various, you know, practices really that people often associate with libraries. So, you know, I think that that's, you know, kind of at a large level, that's really what we're trying to convey in the paper, is that we're dealing with a different public than we have been at any time. You know, in a lot of ways, it's still the same, but now, you know, because people have ready access to information, because they don't have to rely on their library to access certain materials and information, there's something that, you know, there's due diligence on the librarian's part to you know, kind of take into account the fact that not everybody is coming to the table with the same factual basis or evidentiary basis for their beliefs or their claims. Mm-hmm. And so if you have someone that comes in and says, well, why don't you have this work on this, you know, say it's some, you know, conspiracy theory book by Alex Jones or something like that. You know what I mean? Like all of a sudden you have to, libraries, they have to be able to justify and explain why they may or may not, you know, have these things. And so this is something that, you know, things like book bans and challenges and really any kind of, you know, questioning of libraries, just because so many of them are public and they're, you know, funded by the government or, you know, through public funds, they've always had a community to answer to and to try to be sensitive to and respond to. But now it's really on the basis that frequently, especially with conspiracy theories, it's this assumption that libraries are or libraries and librarians and like the policies and the collections they have are actively trying to hurt people. And so that's the worst of it. And I would say that that's just a very small percentage of the people who deal with libraries, because the fact is, over the course of the pandemic, the library activity, even though, you know, most of them were closed for a good chunk of the time, activity was unbelievable. You know, usage and visits and all these other things that you know, you can, you know, you sort of measure library activity by, it was all way up. You know, these were organizations that would respond to the, you know, the situation in their given communities, and they would, you know, restore services, they would boost their internet signal, they would have vaccination clinics, and they would have, you know what I mean? Like there are all these different things that they were trying to do to kind of help the situation out, even though they couldn't necessarily be open in every instance. So I think that they're always trying their best to serve their communities in a way that is responsive to as many people as possible. But that only goes so far. If you have someone who is so convinced of whatever wild conspiracy they believe in, you know, that what do you even do? You know, how do you, how do you deal with that?
Yeah, that is one of the biggest challenges, not only in librarians, but, you know, academia as well.
Sure.
And there's two points I wanted to bring up. The first one was in terms of the relevancy of what the librarian does now. The reason why I asked this question is because as a graduate student, I hardly ever interact with the librarian. And I feel like, you know, with the papers that I've written, the research that I do for this podcast, you know, I can just go on Google and look at the links and read what I need to read without ever communicating with a librarian. And now when you talk about the conspiracy theorists, I mean, that's what they do. And we live in a society where, I mean, you can order food from your phone. Like it's incredible now. You know, you can pay without taking your wallet. And so part of me is like, if librarians are tackling the conspiratorial, you know, mindset, there's a second battle that's going on at the same time, which is how often are people going to librarians and using their services? And I wonder if with the advance of technology, they have made that profession kind of obsolete. I don't know if that made sense.
Yeah, I think I know what you're saying. And I think that that's a common criticism and kind of a way of looking at like how the profession's changed and whether or not we need these institutions, whether the investment in them, because it I mean, frankly, it takes a lot of money to operate a library. You have a lot of capital expenditures with like buildings, with salaries, with all these things. And that's, you know, it's really the human cost, the human expenses, rather, the personnel that you have running these organizations. That's always, you know, kind of the highest to be able to do. So they're difficult, or they can be difficult organizations to maintain. But I would say that they are far from obsolete, to be quite honest. And I don't just say that as someone who is a librarian and who's, you know, known a lot of them, and I've worked in library, but I really believe that. And I think that that's borne out by the usage and by the engagement that they get with their communities. And part of that is, you know, kind of looking and seeing what's being done at the community level and adjusting their programs and services and their approach really to whatever that reality is. They're very adaptable, even though they're kind of, they can be kind of conservative with a small C, in the sense that they're like monumental change can be difficult. They are adaptable, you know, in their particular environment, and they know the community better than anybody else. Not necessarily better than anybody else, but they know their communities very well. So I don't think that, I think that the profession itself is not obsolete. It's just changing and it's adjusting because people do still have questions about information. They still do want reader's advisory. They still do want the types of community services and other things. And I think that, you know, our assumption a lot of times is that everybody has a smartphone. Everybody has high-speed dial-up internet. Everybody has access to adequate reading materials. The fact is that's just not true, especially, you know, if you get into certain communities that have, you know, traditionally underrepresented communities, marginalized communities, immigrants, you know, people that don't have kind of the assumption of, you know, middle class and upper class accoutrement, you know, that we all have. Yeah. So it's so I think that that's a lot of times that's where what libraries are for. Like that's kind of their mission is, you know, it's this information provision, you know, providing information that is good, that is high quality, that their patrons want. But it is also these other, this kind of suite of other community services that they fill gaps. So part of this conspiracy theory, especially like the big pushback by like the, like the Moms for Liberty and like some of these other ones, you know, the ones that go and scream groomer, you know, at people.
Yeah.
Like part of this is that, you know, it's reaction to things like Drag Queen Story Hour and, you know, different books like on LGBTQ and other like sort of identity issues that have found their way into library operations. Well, a lot of this is part of, and this is kind of my own conspiracy theory, but it's true, but it's part of this larger effort in that's been going on. And it's a conspiracy, but there's really no secret to it, but it's really to kind of defund and do away with a lot of public services. This has been a goal of certain groups in this country, particularly conservative, socially conservative, economically conservative organizations in this country for decades. I mean, it's just that's what they've been trying to do. And so a lot of times if you follow the money from these sort of grassroots, quote unquote, groups that show up at library board meetings or that run for office for the library board, or they go to, you know, school board meetings and yell at the public, at the librarians and the teachers, you will find somewhere in there a link to these large funders who basically put out money in an effort.
The Heritage Foundation.
Well, you know, yeah, that, and I mean, there's a bunch of them. There's a lot of like, yeah, different like private ones, but it's really been about for many years, this kind of libertarian vision of defunding public services, of privatizing lots of the public activity, including library operations. And there has been some success in privatizing public libraries. And, you know, so it's, you know, again, it's kind of anti-union, anti-labor, anti-public service. It's all kind of blended together. And I know I probably sound like a conspiracy theorist, but it's pretty well demonstrated. And I think that they do a good job of promoting this idea that certain things are obsolete or that they would be handled better in some other way. And so, I don't know, they haven't been entirely successful because I think people really like their libraries, you know, even if people may have a problem with libraries generally, or like some sort of like a vague philosophical or intellectual problem with libraries, they usually like their own library. You know, there was an instance, speaking of the COVID thing, of here, near where I live now in DeKalb, Illinois, but there was an instance in St. Charles, Illinois, the public library, where people, and it was a number of people that were anti-vaccination, anti-masking, they stormed the library, like demanding to be let in because they believed that, you know, as citizens, it was their right to be able to use the library without any sort of restrictions. And, you know, so it was kind of scary for some people just because, you know, these people show up and all of a sudden they're rushing through your doors. And well, anyway, there was, in, you know, there were other instances like this, but it's like, I have to think that part of this is because they like their library. They want to be in it, but who knows? I don't really know what their motivation is.
Have you ever experienced any hostility from conspiratorial minded or someone that was accused you of being a groomer or anything like that?
No, I haven't personally.
Thank goodness.
A lot of what I read is, that's the thing is I'm not sure how I would react. I think I would probably get pretty angry, but a lot of what you read, it's pretty, even now, there's lots of challenges to books and efforts to kind of do book bans. That's always been the case. It's really exploded in the last couple of years though. But a lot of these are very isolated. You can find instances all around the country, but a lot of it is they're in sort of conservative communities and where there's kind of an upswing in activity. And it's not always related to conspiracy theories, but I think that there probably is a correlation in a lot of them. That'd be an interesting study to see
that would be,
if you could, somehow correlate those things. But I would guess, just my first. But then again, it's hard to say because it's really difficult. And I think that a lot of people that study conspiracy theories, they don't really have a good sense. I think that they can put together a pretty general demographic profile of who buys into these things and who's going to. But I think that they continually find themselves surprised. And when they hear people about, about family members losing other family members who a week before believed something completely different, it's just... Who knows who it's going to impact, how it's going to affect somebody.
It's a complex question that, it's going to take years to figure out. Each person is an individual, and every conspiracy theorist becomes one for a different reason. So yeah, it's an interesting one to look into. The second thing I wanted to get into was on neutrality. Now in your paper, you talk about how librarians need to, again, rethink their stance, and I wonder what the pushback or the consequence of that would be, because as a social work student, the NASW has a pretty transparent position when it comes to politics. We lean to the left, we're for human rights, we support the LGBT, we acknowledge critical race theory, they teach that in our schools, transgender study and whatnot, feminism, but at the same time we alienate the other side of the political party. And there's been times where when I go to these conferences, they're like, where are, these conservative social workers, which I feel like is a contradiction in itself. And because of that, the discipline that I'm studying in has often been accused of being woke. And, these are terms that are pretty common when it comes to describing progressives. And so I wondered, once librarians choose, or, choose, what they stand for, will that alienate a the other side of the political party? And will that, create that distrust? Because, just because a city is blue, is democratic, doesn't mean that everyone is. The city that I come from in Elizabeth, it's a blue city, but, there's definitely some red people in there. And so you built that distrust. So, is that a concern for you?
Oh, I think it's a big concern. And I believe, to me, it seems like especially the academic world in library and information studies, that's kind of the broad discipline, that covers librarians and other information professionals, archivists and whoever else. I think that it generally is especially at that in the different academic institutions, I think it definitely would be probably criticized by some or maybe praised by others as being woke or kind of having, more progressive values and applications and, sort of looking at finding ways to apply critical race theory and other things having to do with social justice and, diversity, equity, inclusion, accessibility, all these things. I think that that's definitely, those are values that you generally do see with librarians, although it's not true across the board. Again, I think that people that work in libraries, it's not just librarians, it's other people who may not have the same academic background or who may not, share the same beliefs, but it's really, kind of trying to manage those things. But one thing I'll say is that there's another article that I have coming out here, actually should be out by now, in a different journal. And we talk about that a little bit, about how a lot of the things that libraries are trying to do in order to make things seem and be more just and more fair and equitable are the very things that are going to inflame, you know, the opponents of those types of things, you know, the people who do criticize, you know, liberal snowflakes, you know, and whatever else, you know, like the criticize drag, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. That's these, I mean, because these things are happening. A lot of what you're seeing, mm-hmm. right now, for example, and like for the sometimes violent reactions against drag queen story hours, these are mm-hmm. going on in small, medium sized cities and in red places, which to me, that's remarkable, because the mm-hmm. fact that this activity is going on in these places where 10 years ago, or even 5 years ago, it probably never would have happened. And so it's so I think that, yeah, to your point, it is very, very possible that some of these things could undermine that trust that they're trying to build, and that sort of assumption of neutrality that libraries are for everybody, that you know, that they don't make decisions based on political preferences or on ideological determinations or anything like that. But another criticism of neutrality, particularly within, I think, like a lot of the scholarly discussions around libraries and information provision, is can anyone ever be truly neutral? I mean, we all mm-hmm. bring ourselves, our biases, our beliefs, our values. We mm-hmm. all bring these to the table when we come to work, to all aspects of our life, really, especially mm-hmm. if it's a public type of setting, like what most libraries are. So mm-hmm. it's like, it's really difficult to be neutral. And then what does that even mean, really, when mm-hmm. when it comes down to it, you know, like how, so it's like, I think that there's a matter of like difficulty, but also just, is it even like feasible? Is it even practical mm-hmm. to be neutral, to stay neutral? So that's part of what like the American Library Association and the different like state professional organizations, they try to balance those things. And I know that neutrality, that was a big value, you know, basically mm-hmm. we provide services, we do whatever we can for anybody, you know, irregardless of who you are. Now, of course, we know that wasn't true mm-hmm. because they did every, you know, they followed along with segregation and with, you know, they provided information to government agencies, you know, for political undesirables mm-hmm. and all these other things. So the idea that they have been neutral in the past, that just doesn't hold water. And so the questioning has become is that, is it really possible to be neutral? Mm-hmm. And I don't think that anybody has really argued that, you know, very seriously, you know, in recent years. But I think that that's not to say that there aren't some transactions or some things that you know, you can be that are impossible, or that make it impossible for you to have like sort of a measured and sort of considered response, you know, or considered action, you know, towards something. I'm not saying that mm-hmm. you can necessarily be neutral, but I think that you can try to be objective. You can try mm-hmm. to be fair. You can try to treat people equally. You know what I mean? Like you can sort of work towards that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're trying to be neutral or that you even can be neutral. You know, it's just a matter of, I think, defining really what your policies are, what your approaches are, what your values are, mm-hmm. and then trying to be consistent with that. And then ultimately, whether someone agrees with you politically or ideologically or not, I think that if you're at least fair and consistent, then hopefully that's enough. But for some people, you know, especially if they really bought into a conspiracy theory, it probably doesn't make any difference what your stance is. Like their mm-hmm. assumptions about that stance, that's going to trump everything.
Yeah. You know, I think someone put it best that from the David Pakman show of, he once said that, you know, if someone was like, is water wet? And you said, I'm neutral in that statement, just because you're neutral doesn't mean you're right. Water is wet. In that same way, like you said before, each and every one of us brings our belief systems, you know, our biases with us wherever we go. And I feel like nowadays it's more respectable to acknowledge those biases than to pretend that people are neutral, because, I mean, that's what conspiracy theorists tend to do. Oh, I'm not from the left. I'm not from the right. You know, these are two wings from the same bird. But I mean, but once you hear what they believe in, you know, oh, you know, I'm anti-vax, you know, oh, I don't, you know, mm-hmm. I don't believe in the LGBT because it's not natural. You start putting those values and you start realizing, wait a minute, you align with the right. So, I mean, at least be transparent. This is why people often criticize me, but I respect people like Charlie Kirk, because even though Charlie Kirk, I disagree with him, right, 99.9% of the time, at least he comes out and he tells you, yeah, I'm a conservative and I am against whatever you believe in. I mean, I feel like that's respectable, right. But again, that's just me.
Right. And I think that there is a part of like kind of social justice that, mm-hmm. that recommends, you move towards social justice if you're able to exist with other people who you disagree with. Like, mm-hmm. if you are able to acknowledge that your common fate in a lot of ways, that like the quality of your life, like sort of your ability to, sort of live your best life, that these things are tied together because you exist in a community together, that you can still disagree, but not to the point where you consider someone else an existential threat to you. I think it's a good way to look at it. Like, you can have disagreements and you can, you don't have to like everybody. Not everybody has to like you. But the fact is like, at some level you do have to exist, because otherwise it's just total war, the whole time. And so I think that the danger with conspiracy theories is that they're really hard for people to, it's really always seeking out an enemy. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, it's always looking to try to identify what is the cause of my problems or of society's problems, mm-hmm. or, whatever ills, mm-hmm. are going on in the world. And so it makes it hard. It makes that interaction, like you said, like, even if you agree with somebody, I mean, if there is no shared basis for facts and for what, and someone considers you a threat just by your very existence, I mean, how, mm-hmm. What can you even do then?
Yeah.
No, so I don't know. It's difficult.
It's difficult, dangerous, and it's all around bad.
Yes, it is.
But, it is. Moving forward, the next thing I want to talk about is what has caused, in your opinion, the increase in conspiratorial ideologies. Now, like I think I mentioned earlier, each individual that's a conspiracy theorist has entered this ideology for different reasons. Some people look at the historical events of, like, for example, the Tuskegee experiment of 1932. African Americans, mm-hmm. often use that as a reason not to get vaccinated. We have religious conspiracy theorists that claim that, the LGBT community is a sin, and it's the devil is, messing around with them, whatnot. But I've often said that one of the reasons that we see an increase in these ideologies is because of the inaccessibility of academic, journals. If you were to, Google a certain article, you're faced with a paywall, and I mean there's that blockage, right. And so we have that to consider, and then we're also considering the cost of going to a four-year university. Not everyone can afford it, and I wonder if that has in some way led to this increase, because just a quick story, when I was in public school, I graduated high school with a third grade third grade math level. And, I didn't know how to divide, and it was hard for me. It was hard. And a lot of my classmates also had that same problem, and they ended up dropping out at some point from college. And then like half of the people that were in my eighth grade class ended up succumbing to conspiracy theories, believing that Bill Gates was trying to depopulate the world, mm-hmm. that the vaccines were causing poison. And I wondered if they were to have continued pursuing, their education, would they have succumbed to conspiracy theories as easily as they did? I want to get your thoughts on that.
Sure. I mean, I think that there probably is a correlation between, because I know that there have been studies on, for example, like belief in conspiracy theories, and then how that correlates with like age, educational attainment, geography. There's a big like rural urban divide, mm-hmm. but it's not completely like that. Like there's some nuance to it. Mm-hmm. So I think that it is possible. It is possible that these things are contributing. And I guess I would push back a little bit on the academic journal thing, just because in the sense that like access to scholarly resources, that is a problem, no doubt about it. Like it's it's a huge problem for libraries, especially because a lot of these journals, they're very expensive. And what happens during
$43.
What happens during the scholarly research process is that the different professors and scholars at universities, they work very hard to get tenure, which means they have to publish in these different journals and they have to publish books. And so what happens is they do all this work to publish in these books, and then they take that research, these books, or these different publishers, they take that research and they sell it back to those institutions. So essentially institutions are paying for it twice. They're paying for it for first instance with the labor it requires to produce this work, and then the second time to buy it back when it's repackaged and finished. Mm. So there's that part of it. And then the other thing, though, you know, looking in terms of like public access to this, is that, yeah, there's the firewall, but I think it's also, there would be some problems with how it translates and kind of comprehensibility of it. Because a lot of scholarly journals and just scholarly works generally, they appeal to a very small audience. I mean, it's essentially academics writing for other academics. And so it's hard. And that's, I think that this is part of the kind of cognitive dissonance with things like critical race theory, is that these things were created and kind of mulled over for decades in the academy, and then they sort of slipped out, you know, as the different ideas or concepts were being operationalized in various institutions. And there was very little understanding of that, the kind of scholarly communication that went on before it became this wide thing that, you know, now everybody knows about. And so I think that that's true with a lot of things. You know, universities are kind of these experimental, places where, you try to hash out these ideas and create new knowledge and do all that. But so I guess I'm not sure how much I would like to think that if people had more ready access to that type of stuff and they were able to take it, because honestly, there's stuff that I try to read that, and you know, and I have a fairly high level of education. I've been doing this for a while, and I have no idea what it,
PhD
what it
candidate.
Is. Yeah, well, that's the thing, is like I you know, certain topic areas, like especially when it comes to like looking for a lot of the research I've been doing in like the health sciences and stuff, like I have no idea, you know, what this stuff is like from a disciplinary, you know, standpoint. So,
oh yeah, the methodology section is the worst, and you don't know what's going on. Those graphs,
exactly, exactly. Like I can't say for sure that this is 100%. You know what I mean? Like I have no basis for judging like how its merits. And so it's, so I think about that, like, so someone who maybe doesn't have like a you know, comparable background, you know, what are they to make of it? So,
I see.
So yeah. I think that there's a lot of responsibility for journalists and, you know, news publications to try to get these things right, but they don't necessarily always want it to be, like, they'll report on what they think is interesting, what they think is going to be the most, get the most reaction, you know, or it's going to get the most clicks or the most, and I'm not saying that they're being dishonest about it, but it's like, you know, they have their own motivation. They're not necessarily there to, you know, build knowledge and to kind of influence people and at least not in that way. And so it's, I don't know, it's very complicated. I think the access to education, though, that is a really important part of this as well, because the costs have been skyrocketing. Everything from, you know, textbooks have always been ridiculously expensive, and just with there's been a lot of disinvestment, particularly at the state level in public education, higher education. And you just have, you know, basically the best and brightest are going to these Ivy League schools, and then they're going and they're becoming hedge fund managers, you know? So it's,
and here I am working at Amazon.
Well, this education, I think that it's part of why there are these kind of separations, like economically and demographically in this country. Like it's partially responsible for the discrepancies in wealth, you know, kind of between the haves and the have nots. I think it's also, part of the sort of animosity between red and blue America as well. So that's not to say there's anything wrong with higher education, but I don't know that we're necessarily doing it the best that we can.
Yeah. And just to note for the listener, it's not necessarily that you know, if you don't go to college, you'll become a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
Or, you know, because we know plenty of people with PhDs that are conspiracy theorists. You know, Robert Malone is a good example. So, but, you know, I've always wondered, you know, I want to see a paper that like kind of like goes deep into that and see if it answers my question. It would be an interesting one to go. But anyway, so, you know, final question, and this is about media literacy. So often experts suggest that media literacy should be taught to increase analytical skills, but this is often taught by the institutions that are already being stigmatized by conspiracy theorists and skeptics, you know, academia, the mainstream media. And, you know, one of the media literacy institutions, organizations is News Media Info. And when you go to their, you know, their partnership page, you realize that they're partnered with CNN, MSNBC, you know, NPR, the New York Times. From a conspiratorial perspective, I mean, that's the enemy.
Right.
So, so how effective is news media literacy? And why does these mainstream institutions have the right to claim that we'll teach analytical skills? Because to a certain degree, I mean, it's safe to say that, you know, not everything that's in the mainstream media is true. You know, we have to be skeptical about what's reported on, you know, CNN, the New York Post, the New York Times. But if those same institutions are going to say, we're going to teach you analytical skills, I mean, is it reasonable to be surprised when conspiracy theorists are saying you're a sheep for buying into news media literacy? I want to get your thoughts on that.
So media literacy and information literacy more generally, or more specifically, I guess, to libraries, that's been a big topic for a lot of years. There's been a lot of, particularly at the university level, information literacy instruction and courses and other efforts, you know, to try to make people more discerning information consumers and to kind of think critically and analytically about things like news sources and books and, you know, to be able to take something and say, you know, what is this? Is it true? Does it make sense? What is the evidence? You know, et cetera, to kind of have this, you know, more well-rounded approach to how they make decisions, you know, and kind of how they understand the world around them. So that's been going on in universities, particularly university libraries, for years and years and years. I don't know that it's any it's very effective. I don't know that it really how much of a difference it makes, because as you said, especially when we're talking about conspiracy theories and very savvy disinformation or misinformation campaigns, it's just really difficult to know. And again, you just can't account for like how different people are and how they're going to react. So I don't think, and then, so thinking about the mainstream media or just the media generally, I think that you make a good point that this is something that conspiracy theorists and like people who are just skeptical of everything, I don't think that you're going to get through to them at all. There's in this new paper that I mentioned before, we talk a little bit about this idea of cognitive authority. And this is where you have, you know, every person has this sort of sphere of authority that they put around themselves and they let people in it or out of it. So that it could be people, it could be institutions, it could be a certain text, it could be like a, you know, some sort of a source, but it's basically people and things that one grants that you find believable and credible, you know, that you will, that you look to as an authority. And there's all kinds of factors that could potentially influence this. But really what it comes down to, in a lot of instances, and this is what makes it difficult, but it's because it's really hard to figure out how this actually works. But it's whether someone trusts another person or source or institution or not. Then if you do trust someone, then they are likely to be within that sphere of cognitive authority that you you know, look to for those things that you don't know, because we only know really what we experience. Everything else we know, we have to rely secondhand. We have to rely on another person, another institution. But if we don't trust that other person, they're probably not going to be an authority to this. I mean, what they tell us, we're not going to believe it, right?
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind, and I agree, just a little bit of pushback, was when Donald Trump was like to his supporters, get the vaccine. I mean,
Right.
Donald Trump was the head of the household, I guess. He was the leader of the tribe. And so, but even with his the trust that they had on their leader, there was still pushback.
See, that's a fascinating instance, because I'm glad you brought that up, because I thought that was really remarkable, because there was that one rally that he had that are almost always categorically just like these big like praise sessions for Donald Trump, right? And he did that where he talked about that and he got boos.
Yeah.
And that was really one of the first times where that happened. And you could, I bet if you tracked like kind of his unpopularity and everything that's happened since then, I bet you could track it back to that moment, like where people, like his grip started to lose. And so that's the thing, is that that trust, it can be broken, you know, like it's not like an irrevocable thing. Yeah. And that's what, it's just a really hard thing to describe. Like people have a very difficult time. Like they don't necessarily have rational reasons for trusting other people. You know what I mean? Like, because people that trusted Donald Trump, they also would probably fully acknowledge that, yeah, he's a liar and he cheated on his wife and he, you know what I mean? Like he did all these things that we otherwise wouldn't admire in a person, but for some reason he's my guy. I trust him, you know? Yeah. So it's like, once that's broken, then, you know, things might change. And so to the point of media literacy, I just don't know how conspiracy theorists and skeptics, if there's a path for them to be able to get back to, you know, again, those people that, like you said, they sort of identified as enemies, to where they can trust the media more generally, you know, especially if they're in an instance right now where they get everything that they need, you know, in terms of their information consumption and the confirmation of their own beliefs and disconfirmation of things that they don't believe. And so I don't know. And this maybe is an inroad for libraries, because libraries are very trusted still, even to this day, as far as like, you know, institutions across the board, libraries are very well trusted. And when people, you hear about these people that really get very deep into conspiracy theory communities and kind of down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories, the thing that almost always brings them back, like when in the instances where it happens, is dealing with some sort of a trusted person, like a family member or friend or something, like we'll kind of gradually pull them out of it. And so I think that that's a really key aspect to any of this, is like restoring trust, establishing or restoring trust, or at least the possibility for a space for trust to start growing. Because otherwise I don't know how else it ends. It just becomes even more fractured and crazy than what it is right now.
Yeah. You know, that's the same thing that Aoife Gallagher said when I spoke to her, you know, keep that relationship, you know, don't push them away, you know, don't engage with the conspiracy theory, you know, have a time where when you communicate with someone, just talk about something else, you know, how your day is, you know, but don't engage with the conspiracy theory, but at the same time, don't keep them isolated, because once you lose them to the conspiracy theory and they have no one to communicate with, that's, you know, in reality, it's game, you know, there's just no coming back.
It really is. And then, you know, at that point, you have, you have a situation where I think that a lot of times people, they'll sort of wear themselves out with these conspiracy theories. But if they don't have anywhere else to go, once they're worn down, you know what I mean? Then they'll just go back. They'll just jump back in.
Yeah.
So having that, especially from a trusted voice, but non-judgmental. Yeah. But it's so hard, man. It's hard to like think about that. Like how do you... I don't know.
It goes back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, with the internet, because it's so addicting with the algorithm. It's designed to to keep you, you know, coming back. And man, it's so. But Bradley, I want to thank you so much for your time. You know, this was a great conversation. You said that you had a second paper coming out. Do you know the name of the title for it?
Yeah, well, it's the Journal of Information Ethics. Okay. That's their latest edition. I can't remember. It's about
it's not the one I read, right?
No, it's a different one. About libraries. It's about libraries as trust systems, like kind of in a post-trust world and post-truth world. Journal of Information Ethics.
Yes.
Myself and Hannes Britz were the authors on that.
Okay. Yeah. You know, once I get access to it, I'll read it and I'll leave a link for the listeners so they can, you know, access it and learn, you know, a lot about, you know, how librarians are dealing with this new dilemma of conspiracy theories. So, Bradley, with that being said, I want to thank you so much for your time. This was a great conversation.
All right, Nelson, thank you.
Hi there. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. A few things. I want to thank Bradley for informing me about how important librarians are in our society. As a graduate student that comes from a middle-class family, I forget that other individuals in America don't share my reality. And just because I haven't spoken to my university librarian doesn't mean that other people haven't found libraries and the staff members that operate these institutions as important to their pursuit of health and knowledge. Also, if you listen carefully, you can hear me mispronounce the word librarian as librarian. As I was editing this episode, my girlfriend told me that I said it weird. And so go ahead, make fun of my speech disability. It's okay, it's all good. I major in psychology and social work, not linguistics. In the show notes below, you can find access to Bradley Weil's journal articles for you to read. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please be sure to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. And be sure to subscribe and wherever you listen to this podcast. You can follow me on Facebook and on Instagram for more assessment on the conspiratorial mindset. And of course, share this podcast with your friends to have some interesting discussions about conspiracy theories. So with that being said, take care and question everything with logic. Thank you.